The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Well, Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News show with your host, Don Olson. Dave Gutnick is away today. And so I want to play a few selections that I taped and about things going on in international relations, which has been catching my interest quite a bit. And the first one will have to do with whether the Ukrainians have been accused by Russia of sending 91 or 86 drones over 91 Ukrainian drones to attack this week on a Putin residence in northwestern Russia, a claim that Kyiv, Ukraine, has denied as a lie. Kyiv has denied the allegations of attack on Putin's lakeside country residence and called them a ruse to derail progress in peace negotiations. These are been going on in Mar-a-Lago. And so there's been a lot of downplaying, and the media has played the downplaying by Kyiv. But today we're going to start off the first of few. This will be by Danny Heifong, who's a blogger on YouTube. This is from yesterday that he posted it. And he'll be giving the Russian side of this, Sergei Lavrov's response to the missile attack. And so we'll listen to this, and I'll have another one later in the hour.
And the retaliation from Russia will be brutal. Here's what Sergei Lavrov announced with regard to a massive drone strike that targeted Vladimir Putin himself on his presidential compound. I'm going to read it because it is in Russia. On the night of December 28th to 29th, 2025, the Kyiv regime launched what was a terrorist attack using 91 long-range strike unmanned aerial vehicles on the state of the Russian Federation, the state residence of Vladimir Putin himself. He continues that this was in the Novgorod region where that is located. All unmanned aerial vehicles, all drones, were destroyed by air defense systems of the Russian Federation or Russian armed forces. There were no reports of casualties or damage from the drone debris. And he says, we would like to point out that this action took place during intensive negotiations between Russia and the U.S. to resolve the Ukrainian conflict. He continues that such reckless actions will not go unanswered. Russia's retaliation, the targets for strikes, and the time for their implementation by the Russian armed forces have been determined already. At the same time, Russia is not going to withdraw from the negotiation process with the U.S. However, given the final degeneration of the criminal Kyiv regime, which has moved toward a policy of state terrorism, he continues, Russia's negotiating position will be revised. That is a devastating warning to Ukraine. And that warning comes, of course, after this attack and right before then, on Christmas Day. Vladimir Zelensky's presidential address really is a smoking gun because he wished Vladimir Putin death to the Ukrainian people in his address, and I'll just read that here. He said, if you tell them your dream, it will definitely come true. What is that dream? Well, he says, we all share the same dream. We all have the same wish. We're going to make the same wish, he says. What is that? That he should die. Everyone will say this to themselves. So that was Vladimir Zelensky's smoking gun that he claims actually is no smoking gun, because he's denying this, Ukraine is denying this, and the Institute for the Study of War, the whole Western mainstream media, are calling these just simply allegations. But Donald Trump took them seriously. He was with Benjamin Netanyahu, and as he was giving Netanyahu a tongue bath and saying he was going to bend the knee to Israel on every single foreign policy objective of the United States and, of course, of every policy objective of Israel, here's what he said in reaction to the media asking the question.
Yeah, I don't like it. It's not good. I heard about it this morning. You know who told me about it? President Putin told me about it. Early in the morning, he said he was attacked. That's no good. It's no good.
Russian officials.
Don't forget, you know, the tomahawks. I stopped the tomahawks. I didn't want that. Because we're talking about, you know, it's a delicate period of time. This is not the right time. It's one thing to be offensive, because they're offensive. It's another thing to attack his house. It's not the right time to do any of that. And can't do it. And I learned about it from President Putin today.
He said he was very angry about it. He learned about it from Vladimir Putin on a phone call, and that it's not the right time, and that he didn't authorize tomahawks. He's very angry about this. But what's so interesting is the wording, right? Not the right time. That there could be a right time for the Ukrainian regime to go after Vladimir Putin. Now, remember, Ukraine has been conducting terrorist attacks inside of Russia since the very beginning of this conflict. We had the instance of Daria Dugina, the daughter of Alexander Dugin, the scholar, the Russian scholar. We also, of course, have had multiple bloggers, journalists, as well as top generals be assassinated over the course of the years, including just within the last month, happen inside of Russia, and it was the Ukrainian regime taking credit for this. And sometimes they don't take credit for it, like this one. But this is absolutely unhinged. This is a terrible move, one that has major and massive implications. One, the Russian Federation is saying, this is what they are saying about it. They're saying that this was an attempt to undermine Donald Trump's attempt to negotiate with Vladimir Putin and the U.S. and Russia so-called peace negotiations and Washington's mediation efforts. Dmitry Peskov said the terrorist attack was meant to derail this, and it wasn't just simply an attack on Vladimir Putin personally. It was an act of terrorism aimed at derailing the negotiations. And it's important to note that Russia is calling this across the board a terrorist attack, because this gives Russia every right and every capability to strike against Ukraine in a way that mirrors how Russia would wage a war on terrorism, not simply a special military operation with regards to the objectives in Ukraine that it has. So this is big. And Dmitry Medvedev had much stronger words, as he generally does, the former Russian president, now head of the Security Council. He says, a striking Kiev bastard wants war. He'll have to stay hiding for the rest of his worthless life. He wants war. Well, now he'll have to stay in hiding for the rest of his life. That was Dmitry Medvedev's words. Now, this is a critical moment in the conflict, of course, because this attack came as Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump had a phone call after Vladimir Zelensky met with Donald Trump. All of this happened within a week of this strike and this attack. And John Mearsheimer and so many others were warning that there might be a false flag attack in order to justify the end and the destruction of the negotiations. The problem with this is that it actually puts a big target on Ukraine and signals that Russia should escalate on Ukraine. So rather than getting the U.S. more involved and NATO more involved, this is really to provoke Russia into a massive response that will then hopefully get Ukraine what it wants, which is more money, more arms, and prolonged support, especially from the U.S. itself. But this is a huge problem for Ukraine, because what this has actually done is it has opened up the Oreshnik can of worms. There are major rumors now, major circulation of information saying that Russia could very well use the Oreshnik on decision-making centers in Ukraine, including from Alexei Aristovich, who was once Zelensky's right-hand man. He said this to Ukrainian media. I'll pull it up here. Western countries say the following, that according to their information, there was a strike. It is not me who claims this. He says that's what they say about the drone attack. Second, it was not just a targeting of the residents. It's a special facility of the Russian Federation designed to control the armed forces of the Russian Federation in the event of a nuclear war. So in terms of meaning, it would be as if Ukraine attacked Air Force One. This is a special facility. It is an entire city with external structures, underground structures, and all kinds of communication nodes. According to Western taxi drivers, drones were flying 91, who knows, two or three, but they were most likely through communication hubs. They're clarifying this information, and frankly, they did not fly. But there was a blow. And he continues, why are Russians deeply outraged by this? Because this is a strike on the control center of the nuclear triad of the armed forces of the Russian Federation during a bloody nuclear war. This is an attack by a saint on the saints, according to the Russian nuclear doctrine and the nuclear doctrine of any state that has nuclear weapons. This is a pretext for nuclear war. In Kiev, they will not strike with technically nuclear weapons. They don't have it, according to them. This is a sharp escalation, however, a change in the entire international framework. They won't go, but with all sorts, you may see the hazelnut fly in. And so I want to pause there, because when he says that the hazelnut will fly in, what he's referencing is actually the Oreshnik, because in Russian, Oreshnik actually means hazelnut, and that is the name of the missile. So what Alexei Aristovich is saying here, it's 100% certain that ballistic missiles will fly toward decision-making centers of Ukraine. And this is something that Vladimir Putin actively has tried not to do. And I want to actually now play for you what friend of the show Larry Johnson has to say about this, because he believes that Zelensky wouldn't be so stupid to actually authorize this during talks with the United States. He reported this to RT.
Well, we've got to look at the timing of this. Now, my understanding is that the attempted attack on the residents started at around 10 p.m., 11 p.m. Moscow time, and it extended until, say, 2 a.m. In the morning of the 29th. Well, that time, 10 a.m., Moscow time, was 2 p.m. at Mar-a-Lago. So, in other words, this attack was taking place while Zelensky's meeting with Trump ostensibly to talk peace. I don't think he's that stupid to launch that kind of attack while meeting with Trump. I think this reflects that there is some significant division within Ukraine, that this was carried out with Ukrainian intelligence. It wouldn't surprise me with Budnov being involved and with
British. You think he was actually bypassed?
Yes.
This is the Mercy Capital.
Alone, you're not. At Omnia Tele.
Oh, you want to start now?
So that was Danny Heifong presenting Lavrov, the Russian foreign policy minister, about response to the what they consider the attack, missile attack, on one of Putin's residences, as well as being a place where they have a nuclear response center. So that was yesterday. Next, we're going to go to a segment from Dialogue Works with Nima Elkhorshild. and it's with Max Blumenthal of the Gray Zone, and it's wrapping. It's a 2025 wrap up of the wars of Trump that are still burning. This was posted yesterday.
Hi, everybody. Today's Wednesday, December 31st, 2025, and our dear friend Max Blumenthal is here with us. Welcome back, Max.
Good to see you, Nima.
Please subscribe and hit like button, and you can follow Max on his website, thegrayzone.com. Right below his name, you can find the address, and you can follow him on YouTube, on his YouTube channel, the same name, Gray Zone. Max, let's start with the meeting between Donald Trump and Netanyahu, one of the main issues. Netanyahu, if I'm not mistaken, this is the seventh time that he's in the United States talking with Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was asked about the attack, Israeli attack on Iran. He said that when it comes to the Iran missile program, they can strike Iran. When it comes to Iranian nuclear program, they go fast. And is he giving some sort of permission to Israel to attack Iran again?
He may not know that he is, but he was apparently operating with this mentality in the meeting that he should tell Netanyahu everything that he wants to hear and deliver the goods for Netanyahu, because $500 million in campaign funding with the midterms coming up is attached to it through figures like Miriam Adelson, who is now at the ingathering of the U.S. Jeffrey Epstein class at St. Bart's, this island in the Caribbean where all of the yachts of the wealthy Caribbean residents, including Queen Miri of Miriam Adelson, Jeff Bezos's yacht, David Geffen's yacht, Victor Pinchuk's yacht, they're all there. And they have Donald Trump under their full control. Miriam Adelson speaks for Netanyahu. She represents Israel. Donald Trump just paid tribute to her at his Hanukkah party at the White House, where Mark Levin, who is sort of the voice for Netanyahu in the U.S. media, wrapped his arm around Trump in a way I've never seen anyone do, kind of handling him like a rag doll, and pronounced him the first Jewish president. You could see Trump was even a little uncomfortable about this display, but he knows who's buttering his bread. And that, I think, fueled the embarrassing and dangerous display that we saw when Netanyahu arrived for, what did you say, the seventh time this year? I mean, Trump is effectively the BB sitter, and he has to tend to Netanyahu. And he also seems to believe in it. But Donald Trump, I mean, he's also mentally enfeebled. No one knows what he actually believes in Washington, including the people closest to him. And he's prone to making these reckless statements, whether it's about, what we can talk about later, the CIA supposedly attacking some random dock inside Venezuela, maybe in the city of Maracaibo, or that Iran should not be allowed to have any ballistic missiles, meaning a demand from the U.S. president for Iran to give up its entire deterrence capacity and to basically surrender before the world and before Israel, something Iran would never do. He didn't even say, oh no, they can't have ballistic missiles that have a range of over 1,600 kilometers or something like that. He said all its ballistic missiles, because that's what he thought Netanyahu wanted to hear. And so he sets the stage for war with Iran, something Netanyahu clearly wanted to do, because going into the meeting, Netanyahu tweeted out some AI slop showing him and Donald Trump in the cockpit of a B-2 bomber getting ready to bomb Iran. That's Netanyahu's Hanukkah wish list. And Donald Trump verbally delivered, but I think, you know, you have the Joint Chiefs of the Pentagon, the military leadership, people inside the administration who don't necessarily want to thrust back into a war in which they lost one-third of their stockpile of THAAD missiles, THAAD anti-aircraft missiles, just to defend Israel for 12 days, at a time when the U.S. is beefing up its arms shipments to Taiwan, an imperial carve-out that needs THAAD missiles as much as anyone. And then there's Ukraine. We haven't even mentioned that. So disastrous rhetoric from Donald Trump that may actually have no implications because he's just so far off his rocker. And I would accept the medical analysis of him suffering from some stage of dementia at this point, given his performance just over the past week.
Do you see any sort of connection between what Donald Trump is talking about, considering particularly the case of Iran and Israel, and the midterm elections in the United States?
There was concern and worry among Netanyahu's cutouts inside the United States in the Israel lobby and personally within Netanyahu's camp about Donald Trump's reliability after his meeting with Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, where he made a number of commitments, including delivery of F-35s to Saudi Arabia, and the sheer bribery of Donald Trump by the Saudi royals through their sovereign wealth fund, through this crypto exchange that Trump's sons have set up called World Liberty Financial, which is basically a forum for legal bribery. They were also concerned Donald Trump might even be getting too close to Qatar, which is hosting Hamas political leadership. Donald Trump has accepted hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, worth of bribes, de facto bribes from them as well. So Netanyahu entered this meeting determined for a display of fealty from Trump, that Trump would essentially recognize him as his real boss. And that happened. And I think that was because of the upcoming midterms and Donald Trump's need to fund these midterms and to fund what are, I don't even know if they're MAGA anymore, what MAGA means, but Trump-aligned candidates. And so much of that funding is coming from Likudnik circles tied, Likudnik billionaires tied to Benjamin Netanyahu. So that really is what Trump's rhetoric was about. But Iran demonstrated that it can deter Israel and do significant damage during the last 12-day war. And the U.S. not only suffered because of the amount of armaments and military assets it had to deploy in defense of Israel, but Trump suffered as well within his own base and even among some of his closest allies, including the late Charlie Kirk, who was inside the White House, basically begging Trump not to get involved. So I think it's going to be more difficult to get involved in another conflict. What's taking place now with the protests is something that Israel is seeking to weaponize in order to soften up Iran and to demonstrate to Trump that the government of Iran, the system of the Islamic Republic, is actually weak. And they're doing everything they can to kind of instrumentalize economic protests in order to set the stage for a joint U.S.-Israeli operation.
Actually, as you know, I'm in Iran, and you look at the media, in the mainstream media, even in the alternative media, they're talking about huge protests here in Iran, and people are coming out. There's some sort of localized protest in people like 50 or 60, 100 people gathering, you know, making some sort of argument that the economy is not good and there is some sort of inflation, but there is nothing, you know, that big to be considered as the way that they're trying to picture the situation in Iran. What's your take on that?
Well, have you seen any of the protests? And
I haven't seen just a few videos.
But
and
do you feel like supporters of the Islamic Republic are nervous about the protests? Are they purely economic in nature, or are they ideological?
They're totally free. They're not even trying to avoid them from protesting.
Yeah.
Say, you can do whatever you want, and you can ask whatever you want. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I spoke to two Americans who recently visited Iran and left before the protests erupted, and they did describe to me an inflationary crisis, but I saw that when I was there in May. And Iranians who are middle class Iranian professionals would tell me, like, they're working so hard, but the currency is increasingly worthless, and so they can't buy a new car, they can't really deliver on all of their hard work, and one person said, you know, I feel like a loser. It's just so demoralizing. The mother of a young child, and you know, someone who's extremely competent and would be making six figures in the United States, given their skill set, and that's the issue here. And the people that I spoke to did not blame the system of the Islamic Republic, but that was because these were supporters of the Islamic Republic's overall counter-hegemonic stance on the world stage. They were proud of that, and they were supporters of Palestine. You know, you have others, even in the reformist camp, who question why Iran supports Palestine at all, given the amount of economic pressure and sanctions and danger that it places itself in because of the proximity of Israel. And so, you know, those kinds of people who have less political education and are purely concerned about their middle class status, I think, you know, that those are the people that Israel and its propaganda apparatus are trying to persuade and weaponize. And so far, I'm not seeing that happening, especially after all the civilian casualties suffered in the 12-day war. I think there is more political awareness in Iran, among Iranian, even in the Iranian middle class, about what the stakes are. This is a crisis almost entirely brought on by sanctions. And I don't think there can be any debate about that. I'm sure there's mismanagement in Iran's economy. There's massive mismanagement in our economy as well. I know the last central bank chief was replaced. Now they're talking about replacing the current central bank chief, but the central bank has access to something like $250 billion in reserves. Well, it doesn't have access to that. That's what's in the reserves, but it cannot access that because it's held.
Just checking on the tape here to see what is going on. So that was Max Blumenthal from the Gray Zone, speaking on Dialogue Works with Nima El-Khurshid. Trump's 2025 wrap-up of Trump's war is still burning.
Hi.
So I guess that's all we have of that one. And whole situation there with how the U.S. allows Israel to break all these international rules. They've just stop all these a dozen or so international NGOs from operating within Gaza and the West Bank, such as Doctors Without Borders or the Norwegian Council, who's often they have people on Democracy Now, but and many others that cannot continue to operate. And they've even going to be taking the land or the buildings of the United Nations, who have been there for many, many decades doing humanitarian work and doing educational work. And it's they're saying that this is a total abrogation of the international norms of and they were going to try and sue, but it seems Israel gets away with anything, and that Trump doesn't stop them at all, and that they continue on doing however much damage they want. Why they can pronounce that the first part of this peace agreement with Hamas and having and Israel has been carried out, even though Israel is not letting in hundreds of truckloads of life-saving equipment both for food, medicine, as well as for some ways of building shelters, so people are living out in the open. And it's young babies and young children are dying because because of exposure, and they just get away with it. They've killed several hundred people since this peace negotiation. So it doesn't matter that the Israel has announced 19 new illegal settlements on the West Bank, even though Trump is saying, well, there won't be any new settlements in the West Bank, but they just keep on the government of Netanyahu being very right-wing, and with not much opposition, it seems, on the Israeli public, but you don't seem to know, but there's no demonstrations like there were for the release of the hostages. But it's an ongoing problem of how are the people, the Palestinians, going to live. Well, maybe the whole idea is to kill them all off. It's hard to say. It seems to be mind-boggling how easy it is for Israelis who are in the half of Gaza Strip and how they can just shoot some young kid, older person, who crosses some imaginary yellow line. What is in their psyche that they have no concern for the people, and that they are just totally absorbed by settler colonial ideology? Or is it because of religious ideas? It's, you know, some of that happened here in the U.S. to kill off indigenous people here, that the people coming in to take their land were civilized. So it's a mindset that says it's not ours, but if we want it, it is ours. So that's the situation there that is very just goes against whatever kind of sentiments you think are useful for how to people to live in the world. This is the Northern Sun Radio News Show, and now we're going to have Douglas McGregor, who's a retired U.S. Army colonel in the Armor Division, combat veteran, who he'll be with on Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano, and that was posted on the 30th, Tuesday.
Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Tuesday, December 30th, 2025. Colonel Douglas McGregor is here with us for a year-end review and for what we expect is our final live airing for the year. Colonel McGregor, it's a pleasure, my dear friend. A belated Merry Christmas and early Happy New Year to you, and thank you for joining us today. So it's a year-end review. I have all the hot spots I want to ask you about, but let's start with the breaking news. From your vantage point, have you seen credible evidence that the allegations that the Ukrainians tried to assassinate President Putin yesterday by sending 91 drones to his residence is believable?
Well, they certainly sent the drones to his residence in Novgorod. That's pretty clear. I'm surprised that all 91 of them seem to have either missed the target or been shot down. As to whether or not this was an assassination attempt depends on whether or not the intelligence they had suggested that he was actually at the residence. You know, who knows? I mean, nothing would surprise me. Ukrainians have been assassinating people in Moscow left and right. Recently, a very senior officer, and he's not the first general officer, was killed. You remember, of course, Dr. Dugin's daughter, who was murdered. I guess instead of reaching him, they reached her and blew her up.
Right.
We've had lots of these things. I think what we can say is it was very definite attack on the residents. Why they seem to think that Putin was there is a mystery to me. Maybe they think there's a command center in the residence. Who knows?
President Trump himself told the media yesterday that President Putin himself told President Trump that this happened. Chris, cut number one.
You know who told me about it? President Putin told me about it. Early in the morning, he said he was attacked. That's no good. It's no good. Don't forget, you know, the tomahawks. I stopped the tomahawks. I didn't want that. Because we're talking about, you know, it's a delicate period of time. This is not the right time. It's one thing to be offensive, because they're offensive. It's another thing to attack his house. It's not the right time to do any of that, and can't do it. And I learned about it from President Putin today. I was very angry about it.
And The Guardian reports that Russia has moved more Arushniks into Belarus. Does that surprise you?
Oh, no, I think that was well underway. In any case, they simply pressed the button sooner. the Oreshniks are a powerful deterrent, and I think that's not just meant for the Ukrainians, it's also meant for the West Europeans, particularly in Berlin, Paris, and London. They need to understand that it's the dangerous talk they've engaged in, the threats that they've made, even though the threats are largely hollow, it doesn't make any difference to the Russians. The Russian population and its government are fed up with the entire enterprise.
It appears that Foreign Minister Lavrov captured that impatience when he said, made these comments. It's brief, but it's pretty direct about the drones. Chris, cut number two.
On the night of December the 28th to the 29th in the year 2025, the Kyiv regime, with its aggressive intentions, deliberately carried out a heinous terrorist attack using 91 long-range strike unmanned aerial vehicles, specifically targeting the official state residence of the President of the Russian Federation, located in the historic Novgorod region. Such reckless and utterly irresponsible actions will most certainly not go unanswered. The precise targets and the exact timing for the retaliatory strikes by the formidable armed forces of Russia have been definitively determined and are now set in motion.
Same day that this happened, and you commented about it to me in an email, President Putin appeared in military garb addressing his senior officials. Is this some kind of a message that he sends when he periodically appears in military uniform?
Yes, unquestionably. Let me say a couple of things, first of all. This war, and there are two kinds of wars, for instance, that our friend Clausewitz mentions. He talks about wars of decision and wars of observation, or what we would call wars of choice. For Russia, this is a war of decision. The matter is existential. Russia's life as a nation, as an independent sovereign state, is at risk. And thus far, we've had this thing called the special military operation. They still use those terms. But in fact, this war has changed dramatically. What started out as a limited special military operation designed to signal Russia's interests, its legitimate security concerns, has now become this war of decision, a war for the existence of Russia and its population. Ukraine is the instrument. And when I say instrument, I mean instrument. It is simply the puppet regime and the human capital that is being squandered on the battlefield on behalf of the globalist governments in Europe and Washington that want to destroy Russia. He puts on the uniform at this point and shows up at a general staff meeting with the senior military leadership as a demonstration that this is now a war for the existence of Russia. And the patience that once existed, I think, is running out. And that is patience with us and patience with Europe. You know, I think that President Putin always tries to be polite. And he listens carefully to whatever President Trump says, and I think he believes President Trump is quite sincere, as he has said. But he has seen repeatedly that President Trump is unable to deliver on much of anything, that the United States Congress has a mind of its own, that the same people that are pressing for war in the Middle East and pressing against Venezuela are equally interested in destroying Russia. And those people, whether they're the major billionaire donors or members of the Senate, it doesn't make any difference. They seem to wield more influence and power than President Trump. And that's, I think, the message that President Putin is saying. Thank you very much. We appreciate your kind words. We are now at war for our existence, and we are prepared to take this war all the way to Europe if necessary.
Our friend and colleague Larry Johnson suggested earlier today that MI6 was probably involved in the delivery of, or attempted delivery of, these 91 drones to President Putin's house. Would that surprise you?
No, I think MI6 has always been in the lead. The British seem to be most interested in the destruction of Russia, of the various European states. When I say British, I'm not talking about the British people that don't have any interest whatsoever in going to war with Russia, but its government. So I think that's true, but we should not lose sight of the fact that regardless of whatever President Trump says, whatever directives he issues, the CIA is still heavily engaged in Ukraine. They continue to provide valuable intelligence through the NATO military structure down to the people who are still trying to hold the regime together in Kiev. And I'm sure that we had at least some targeting information that we provided as well. This is what's so disappointing. President Trump says one thing on the phone, and as I said, President Putin recognizes that he's probably sincere, but things continue unchanging. It reminds me of his last year in office in 2020 when he was telling everybody, I'm withdrawing our forces from Syria. And people in the chain of command actually told him, oh, yes, they're out.
And they weren't.
We're left.
Right. Just before we move to a different topic, The Guardian is reporting of speeches on the floor of the Russian Duma this morning, Tuesday, December 30th, beginning the process of reclassifying. And from what you've told me, the wording means a lot to the Russian people and to the military. Reclassifying this from a special military operation to an all-out war.
Yes. You'll remember a few days ago that President Putin made some remarks at a press conference. And these remarks were very straightforward. It was a warning to our European allies in NATO. If you press this thing and you truly want a war, we Russians are prepared for it, and we're prepared to destroy you. Now, the Russians have done a number of things. I was amused yesterday. There was an announcement of another 135,000 draftees. Russia has a selective draft that are moving into the force. But what's much more important is that somewhere is between 650 and 750,000 reservists have been called up. Of that number, it's expected that 300,000, maybe 400,000, somewhere in that range, will be retained on active duty after this initial mobilization. You have on the ground in Ukraine, what, 750 to 800,000? You add these numbers up, and now you're looking at more than 1 million men mobilized, ready to fight. And you have them organized along multiple axes from Kherson all the way up to the border with White Russia or Belarusia. Russia is getting ready. They're taking the statements that may have been made unseriously, very seriously. If you talk to the soldiers on the ground who are rotating in and out of Ukraine, the Russians, my sources tell me not only is their morale very high, but they're very well informed. They understand exactly what is happening, and they are making it clear to anyone who asks them that they're preparing for war against Europe. That needs to be understood. Doesn't matter that the British people, the German people, the French people have said, no, thank you very much. The fact is their leaders continue to talk stupidly about engaging in a war they have no chance of winning and puts everything at risk in their countries. And the Russians understand that. They're prepared for it down to the lowest level. Every Russian soldier that you talk to says the same thing. We are preparing for war with Europe. Ukraine is not a sideshow, but it now shrinks to insignificance next to the larger fight for the very existence of Russia.
Well, how reckless is NATO, and how much longer can it survive without vast amounts of American support?
Well, you know, this is a good question. When we say vast amounts of American support, what's really critical to them is the command, control, communications, computers, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. That's very important. Their industries obviously are stretched to produce munitions and rockets and missiles for their weapon systems. But they are capable, if they're willing to devote themselves to the prospect, and that seems to be the case in Germany, for instance, if they're willing to borrow endlessly, putting themselves deeper and deeper into debt, operating with very fragile economies as much as we are, they're pretty powerful. But keep in mind, regardless of what President Trump says, we continue to do everything we possibly can in support of this operation. Now, we're not sending as much money as we did. Most of the equipment that we've promised won't show up for years. But the point is, today, what is happening right now, whatever we've got, we've given, whatever intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance data we could provide for targeting and attacks we give, those things have not changed. I don't see that ending unless President Trump gets personally involved, and I don't think he has. I mean, quite frankly, it's astonishing to me that this man Ratcliffe is still running the CIA. The CIA seems to be a rogue organization that does pretty much what it wants anywhere it goes, regardless of what the president says. And that's huge.
Of what?
So that was retired U.S. Army Colonel Douglas McGregor. He was in the combat. He was served in wars, and on Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano. Now, a little background, and certainly the Germans have been involved with the whole build-up of NATO after the 1991, when the promise was given to Gorbachev by U.S. State Department that if Germany were allowed to, East and West Germany were allowed to reunite, NATO would not move one foot to the east. That was 91, but then Bill Clinton came in, became president, and during his second term, they had three countries were added from Eastern Europe into NATO, going against this. It was Poland, the Czechs, and Romania. And it's been a build-up ever since. And Germany knows all about this, but they, surprisingly, I listened to some of the German, the new, relatively new chancellor in Germany, very bellicose, very, Russians are coming for us. Whereas the other way around is that NATO, which Germany is part of, has been expanding and now has weapons, missiles in Romania and Poland that could easily hit, Moscow, they're 9 minutes away. And if the Ukraine, which juts way into Russia, was allowed to become part of NATO, missiles could be placed way to the east, which would be only then 5 minutes away. But they're talking about this, and on Deutsche Welle, which is called German World, Channel 2 in the late afternoon during the, sometimes it's on 2, sometimes it's on 2.3. They've been talking about really worried about their existence, and it's trying to build up a war footing, even though they have been very unpopular among populace of Germany, as is the French government, who are also doing very bellicose, and as well as the deeply unpopular Labour government in the United Kingdom. So it's, I know in Germany, they've talked about having a huge program of getting bridges set up so tanks could easily go across them, so that and that they could have tank travel being facilitated throughout the country. And it's they really don't have the possibilities of going forward with that. And it's and the one thing to remember, of course, is that this war could have been over almost at the beginning. There's many other things that we, Dave Gunick and I, talk about leading up to it. But the thing to remember that after December 21, 2021, the Russian idea for having a new structure of security arrangement in Europe was turned down. Then it was 3 months later that they went into Ukraine, and February 22nd. Well, at the end of March, there was a meeting in Istanbul, Turkey, and they it was a kind of a peace agreement with between Russia and Ukraine, and Russia would withdraw all of its military to the original borders of the Ukraine, and the Ukraine would be neutral. The Russian language would be allowed to be part of the official language structure as it in the Ukraine. But this is all penciled. There's a few more things to it than that. But the war would have been over just a month after it started. And Boris Johnson, who was then the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, flew to Kiev, Ukraine, and told Zelensky, nope, don't sign it. The West will back you. So this last almost 4 years, this has all been war brought about by the West. And the West keeps giving weapons, keeps promoting it. Or as Senator Lindsey Graham put it when he was over there, we'll back Ukraine until the last Ukrainian. Well, they've lost a lot of Ukrainians. So it's a very ominous thing that is never mentioned. There was one time that I know of on PBS NewsHour that they briefly referred to that. But it's this war is NATO, U.S., and that these are the people who are responsible for everything, last 4 years of what the war has been. So it's but the whole idea of the propaganda of the how to assess it makes it out that Russia did it unprovoked. Hundreds of times they said it was unprovoked. We've presented many things, many other agreements that were broken with Russia, the Minsk 1 and 2 agreements back in 2014, 2015, the overthrow of the Prime Minister in the Ukraine in 2014, and there are all these various things that the U.S. has been involved with. But it's well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News with your host, Don Olson, and we're going to have a special guest coming on.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
The Industrial Revolution was powered by steam. In the 19th century, passengers cruised on steamships They traversed North America in steam locomotives. Steam pumped water, steam ground wheat into flour. Today, if you want to experience the steam era, you have to go to a museum. Unless you just happen to be passing through Cleveland, Minnesota. The Geldner Sawmill remains standing where